Good morning, everybody. I'll try to keep you in time. Sorry to be late. We still have 30 minutes. Yes, excellent. I'm super happy to be here. This is my first time in Hungary, my first time in Budapest. I'm very much looking forward to spending this day with all of you. What I'd like to do is just briefly touch upon some stories that have to do with Muslims. Technological change. But before we do so, I'd like to make a literary remark. Thanks for the great introduction. And I'd like to take a step back with you to the end of the first book of the Cromwell trilogy written by Laurie Mantel. As for translating, if I might ask the question who's read it, Mantel is growing up at random times, so I'll just skip that question for now. But in the end of the book, Thomas Cromwell, 16th century smart guy, basically, he wonders what the printing press is doing to institutions. He basically says, not that everybody can print books. There are so many books, you can't read all of them anymore. And this is going to drastically change the world we live in, he says, at least in the words of Hilary Mantel. And he's kind of worried about that. What does it do to religion if everybody starts printing books? This technology is really destroying the world we live in. Fast forward to another fictional family, 400 years later, Downton Abbey fans. Who's a Downton Abbey fan? One hand, two, three, some champion, one in the back. Excellent. At the end of the first season, the telephone is introduced into this British aristocratic family. Again, and you can see Maggie Smith there using it for the first time. A revolution. Telephone. Why would you want to talk with people? We live in another village. We can't just talk with each other this way, right? Why do we need a telephone? This is going to dramatically change the British aristocracy and other institutions. The world is never going to be the same. Again, a contemporary fictional account of the introduction of a new technology in an old institution. And I'm fascinated by these examples, and I try and look for them everywhere because they tell two important things. The first thing they say is, well, new technology is always a bit scary, maybe at first. But the second thing, and much more importantly, what they tell is that we today are looking at examples of ways that new technologies have changed the society we live in, have changed the institutions we're working for. So, let's see if I have sound. Should be, yeah. My question and my work revolves around wondering how these technologies and this sound and this telephone, how they impact museums and other cultural institutions and heritage institutions. So what is it? What changes do these technologies bring into our daily life? And how do we respond to that as organizations? What do we do to make them work for us? Much like Thomas Cromwell started the Reformation, or at least spread its ideas around, and much like the British aristocracy, isn't really as successful anymore as they were in the First World War. So my work basically revolves around this long list of things. On the one hand, changes in technology. All the stuff you've been hearing about yesterday, everything that's happening in the world around us today. You can hardly open any newspaper without seeing new things added to the list. On the other hand, these changes never come along. They transform the way our society works. They transform the way we think, the way we do, the way we act. And both of them, like we as museums, we're kind of squeezed in the middle. On the one hand, technology never ends society. And if we don't have a building as big as this one, we'd be run over a long time ago. So my work is to try and find solutions to these challenges. And to make it super practical, and because I have 30 minutes, which is more than enough, I'd like to just briefly ask you a short question. Think for 30 seconds, not a second more. Talk with your neighbor. What is the number one challenge? Social or technological affecting your organization. Your jealous of your face. 30 seconds. I'm running, and then we're going to say angry, or Amos, or friends, or anyone that you like, all at once, right? So 30 seconds, I'll bring you over. And 10 seconds for translation.
Going strong, going forward. What I'd like to do with you is I'd like to share four stories of
museums that face big issues, that face big challenges, and show how they responded to this using technology, using the new way society works, etc. And I'd like to tell you a story about a medical app that makes people better, a museum app that makes people better. I'd like to tell you about the transformation of my favorite museum in the world, and I'm not biased, I'm just looking to the person. I'd like to talk about how a small Italian museum made 100,000 euro and a lot of friends, and I'd like to tell you a short little story about the oldest factory in the world and how they're reinventing engineering. But first, I'd like to look with you at what is really happening. You know, I'm talking about technological and social change. What is really changing? Well, I guess this is always my favorite way to look at it. Information control as well. Become radically different from the way it was 2 years ago. This is by now a known fact, but 90% of all data in the world has been produced in the last 2 years. That means that everything, this entire museum, all the books that you have in your literary museum, and most of the Facebook updates and photos from when you were young, and everything is nothing compared to the amount of information and data we're producing and creating today. And this changes the way we work. For instance, it changes the kind of professions that will be having in the next 10 years. If you're looking for a career chance, here's the top 10 new jobs for the next decade. I especially highlighted two: social education specialists, which I guess most museums, they are education specialists, but not in social. And I like the other one, extinction revivalists. That's somebody who revives extinct animals. There's a project going on in Canada, the Royal Ontario Museum, where they're trying to be extinct or revive a certain type of pigeon. I don't know why they picked a pigeon, and I'm kind of worried about this movie called Jurassic Park, but now with pigeons. But it's a job we as museum people might have. At the same time, we see and this is a wake up call. We see that if we ask the audience, they don't want to be educated, they don't care about the information. This is a list of what people appreciate in museums. And I've highlighted the educational experience. People like clean toilets better than a good educational program. So, invest in clean toilets.
Seems to be the lesson here. So what do they like?
Well, this is just some of the kind of shocking statistics that come out of this world transformed by technology. 8 seconds is the average attention span. I just yesterday read that for museums it's gone down to 9 seconds, so we're still slightly better at average, but we're worse than goldfish, who happen to have 12 seconds of attention span. And this one here, there's more cell phones in the world
than toothbrushes.
This is especially shocking if you realize that 90% of all people take their smartphone to the toilet. That's not a really bad thing. The bad thing, if the next thing you do is show your baby photos, look, hold my phone, it's full of nice baby photos. You don't want to ever take it.
They're the most dirty things in the world. So what do people do? They're spending almost 6 hours a day on digital media, not using these. What do they do? What do they watch on digital media? Did this come to Hungary as well? Have you seen it before? I saw some people on Hollywood. I'll keep it till the chorus. So you have it in your head already. Says himself, and what he says is, if you look at today, the culture we're living in is a culture made up by pacemakers, creative participating communities, and complete unexpectedness. Three core ingredients of what has changed in culture and in society because of YouTube, because of the digital revolution. And I just happen to think that we, as cultural institutions, are super good at these three things. Complete unexpectedness. We are the guardians of the stuff that is new, unexpected, special, that's valuable to society. We're tastemakers, because people come to us to learn things, to find out new things, to discover new things. The only thing we're not as good as is creative, participating communities. Getting groups of people to work with us rather than we work for them. All this has a tremendous impact on the way museums work. This is a research done by the Museum Office, the Institute of Museum and Library Studies in the United States. And you can see how all these changes transform our institutions from traditional to the new ones. And I guess the most important thing to notice is this is a transformation from becoming an isolated institution to an institution at the heart of society that works with its audience and is driven by its audience, focused on its audience. So maybe it's not easy to be a museum in the 21st century with all these changes. I have never seen a museum create a video like the one I just showed you. Maybe it's not easy. Well, I think not. Chelsea and Westminster Hospital happens to be a museum. This is a hospital where there are so much art on the walls that it's an official museum status. And they were challenged. They were challenged by the NHS, the British Healthcare Service, to come up with a solution to use this art to make people better. As you may know, the NHS has to make secure budget. They have to put £2 billion from their annual budget, £2 billion, it's a lot of money. How can art help? Well, they created an app that allows you to advise all patients and other people in the hospital to look at the art on this app. They compose music to go with the art, and they handed out audio guides, like all we all have in the audio guide. People borrow these guides, patients borrow these guides, and we go through the hospital looking at the art, listening to these compositions. It's a super simple concept, we can all do it. What happened is 100% of the patients, well, you can read it for yourself, who did so were relaxed by the guys. 100% had their boredom alleviated, and 100% of the patients who used this system experienced a psychological lift. They felt happier because of the art, because of the music. On an average, this app managed to reduce the time people spent in the hospital by 1 day. Now, 1 day doesn't sound like a whole lot. You know, today is 1 day. But if you have to stay in the hospital and it stays 1 day shorter, that's a significant impact. And in fact, if you calculate it over all the hospitals in the United Kingdom, that saves the NHS, the health service, £1 billion. We can do this with our audience. We can actually make people better. We have to focus and realize that these technologies, they're about people. They're about making new connections possible with people. They're not about the art, they're not about, you know, the audio guy talking about the art. They're about the audio guy making people better. Which brings me to my second case and my favorite museum of all. Who has been to the Rijksmuseum? I get a 10% of your ticket every time I see it. The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, as you may have known, has been closed for a long while. It reopened slightly over a year ago. What they did is, first of all, they created a wonderful experience in the building, but a very technology low experience. It's the art, it's human art. But they realized that a visit to the museum alone is not what they're for. They're for sharing the best that the Dutch art history has to offer. So, and you probably have seen this, probably more people have seen this website than have gone to the museum. So, who has seen the new website of the Rijksmuseum? Yeah, all right, it's about the same as the people who've actually been, but it's different people. Different people have gone to this tremendous website and have gone to the museum. And they realize that if we put our art out there, and a super high quality everywhere, people will work with it. But it didn't stop there. They allow people, and this is where the creative participating communities come in, they allow people to remix them. But still, all this is not very new. You know, we've been doing web expos for a very long time right now. What they did, and what is quite amazing, is rather than stopping there, they said, what are people doing online with creativity? And they started to cooperate with this platform called Etsy, which is a marketplace for crafts. So if you're actually very good at knitting, or at painting stones, or creating shoes, you go to Etsy and you sell your services to people around the world. They've worked with Etsy, and they've said, why don't all these creative people around the world use our collection for their creativity, and create products based on our collection? So they made a silk flower based on a Vermeer painting, which you then could sell anywhere around the world, really spreading the collection. Not by the museum talking down to people and saying, here's the collection, work with it, but by looking at what people are already doing, by looking at the creative participating communities that are there right on the web, and using their energy to spread the collection. I call this a social institution, and it's quite often my work to help institutions search from traditional to social. And a social institution is a place where audience and employees systematically work together to co-create value. That means it's not the employees working for the audience, or the audience for the employees, but both of them together working at creating value. And this value can be educational value, it can be cultural value, it can be social value, it can be even money. Which brings me to my next stage, which is the Palazzo Madama in Italy. I realize some of you may have been here actually, because it's really close by. I see some people not. Great. I've never been, but this is a pity, because I think it's a wonderful institution. The Palazzo Madama is a small city palace in the city of Turin, Italy. And about a year and a half ago, they were faced with this unique opportunity to buy this object for the museum. It was going to auction in London. And they said, this year that's it here. I hope I pronounced it right. It was going to auction in London for about 80,000 euros. And they had about 2 months to buy it. So this is not a museum that has 80,000 euros just lying around. For them, this was a lot of money. What this museum does have, however, is a very good connection with the local town, like the people of Turin. They have a very strong relationship with some individuals in the city. So what they decided to do is they decided, like many museums have tried to do, they decided to enlist these people, their friends, in the process of buying this Synthesia. And then they started a crowdfunding campaign. Crowdfunding is a word that's been around for a couple of years now, and it basically is nothing more than you invite all your friends to chip in some money while you're going to buy something. So they decided all their friends to, they asked all their friends to participate, and you can already see from this screenshot what is happening, what happened. But what happened is quite amazing. They managed, by doing so, by connecting with the existing community, they managed to raise over 100,000 euros and buy the objects. More surprisingly, they managed to do this with 1,500 people. 1,500 friends. Not Facebook friends, the ones you never talk to, but friends willing to pay to help this museum out. And that's quite amazing, because what happens if you have 1,500 friends, this happens. They all go, they all want to see it, they all have an opinion, and they all share, and they all participate, and they all work with you to fulfill the mission of your institution. I don't know a lot of museums that we have 1,500 friends, real friends, friends willing to pay a lot of money for them to stay open. And this is only a small museum. They raised 100,000 euros, but it's very important to realize, and if you talk with people from Palazzo Maggi, you'll hear them as well, that this wasn't about money. Again, this was about working with the people in Turin to obtain something with significant value, cultural value, social value for the city. So the value we're talking about can be way more than just money. Which brings me to my last and probably favorite museum case. The story of the Derby Silk Mill. Now you may know that the Derby Silk Mill is the oldest existing factory in the world. It's an 18th century silk mill, obviously a place where they made silk in the city of Derby, that over the centuries, of course, stopped being a mill, and about 40 years ago was transformed into a museum of industrial heritage. So a museum that told the story of the first factory, the oldest existing factory in the world. It's not the first factory, I always mix it up. Here you see all the images of it. Unfortunately, the museum wasn't going well. 40 years ago, they built it, and still more or less looked the same. So people were staying away. A couple of years ago, it even had to close its doors after it lost most of its funding. It all felt like the museum was over, it was gone, it would never be there again. But that wasn't the end of the story. They decided that this museum had value in the 21st century in Derby, that it was meaningful to the local community. They just didn't know how. So what they did is they started inviting the people of Derby in. And they started asking them very simple questions. What are we? Why do we exist? What is the value of the Derby Silk Mill in Derby? Derby is not a big industrial city. I think Boeing is there and some other big companies. So there's a lot of engineers, there's a lot of people who build wonderful stuff. And people came in and they say, yeah, we need a place where we can work. Managers from the factories that came in and said, I want to be an engineer, I want a place where I can work with my hands. Young people came in and they said, we believe Derby can be a design city. And all the people came in and they said, we want to know where all this started. So they invited people in to share their thoughts about what a museum could be. And they went even further. They co-designed the museum.
museum. So they got all the old stuff. They emptied the space, they literally emptied all the galleries. They invited everybody in and they discussed everything. What is this room for? And people said, well, we need this place where we should hold concerts, where there should be music. They said, fine, organize a concert. Bring in your friends, because we don't know if we can organize a concert this evening. Bring in your friends. You know, if other people said, this should be a maker space, where we don't know if we're next, they said, fine. Build a maker space. We as a museum don't know what it is or how it works. But you do, you seem to be. So come here and create it.
And what happened, and this is just some of the, I love this image. This is the museum, the ground floor, the map. And you can see how they invite people to share their thoughts about what could happen anywhere, how many thoughts there were. And they went really far. They organized a design competition. They had a musical concert. They had lots of people come by and redesign this museum from the ground. Even going as far as having the people themselves build the museum. So this is a display case. You can see they're not the typical display cases because they were built by the audience participating in the museum using 3D printers. This is a museum that decided to do it the entire way around. Invite a creative participating community around their unexpected content, the industrial heritage of the city of Durban. Invite them in and become a taster together with them. That creates value continuously together with their audience. As I said, I've been doing this for a couple of years. I'm helping organizations think about projects like this and restructure themselves so that they can be more social organizations. And I've, 2 or 3 years ago, developed a framework together with my friend Jim Richards from the UK that helps organizations do so. Just the other week, I simplified it a lot. So this is it, it's a super simplified version. And basically it summarizes this talk. So if you take one thing away, take a picture and we're done. But if you'd like to know more about how you can do this yourself, how you as a museum or heritage site or a cultural institution, how you can work with your audience to create value rather than for your audience, we've created this little book. It's called Digital Engagement in Heritage, Culture and the Arts. You can download it for free from this website. And it contains many of these case studies and much more, plus the framework that helps you go through it step by step. I've been, as I said, I've been working with loads of organizations. And people sometimes ask me, what do you need for a museum to be successful in the 21st century? Do we need a lot of money? Do we need better objects? Do we need to reach young people? I believe all these, they're important, but they're not the first step. The first step, what we need to do is invite people in and try and become more social institutions. As employees, work with their audiences and create value together with them. And if we do so, if we look at the institutions that have done so in the recent past, we can be super successful. And I believe that's just on the 30 minutes. Thank you very much.